investigation sector to erudite headquarters to keep on her bedside table. Maybe it was her way of rebelling against the faction system. On the screen, Evelyn balances her chin on her hand and stares at the sculpture for a moment. Then she gets up and shakes out her hands and leaves the room. No, I don't think the sculpture is a sign of rebellion. I think it's just a reminder of Tobias. Somehow, I never realized that when Tobias charged out of the city with me, he wasn't just a rebel defying his leader. He was a son abandoning his mother. And she is grieving over it. Is he? Fraught with difficulty as their relationship has been, those ties never really break. They can't possibly. Zoe touches my shoulder. You wanted to ask me something? I nod and turn away from the screens. Zoe was young in the photograph where she stood next to my mother, but she was still there, so I figure she must know something. I would have asked David, but as the leader of the Bureau, he is difficult to find. I wanted to know about my parents, I say. I'm reading her journal, and I guess I'm having a hard time figuring out how they even met, or why they joined abnegation together. Zoe nods slowly. I'll tell you what I know. Mind walking with me to the labs? I need to leave a message with Matthew. She holds her hands behind her back, resting them at the bottom of her spine. I am still holding the screen David gave me. It's marked all over with my fingerprints, and warm from my constant touch. I understand why Evelyn keeps touching that sculpture. It's the last piece of her son she has. Just like this is the last piece of my mother that I have. I feel closer to her when it's with me. I think that's why I can't give it to Caleb, even though he has a right to see it. I'm not sure I can let go of it yet. They met in a class, Zoe says. Your father, though a very smart man, never quite got the knack of psychology. And the teacher, an erudite, unsurprisingly, was very hard on him for it. So your mother offered to help him after school, and he told his parents he was doing some kind of school project. They did this for several weeks, and then started to meet in secret. I think one of their favorite places was the fountain south of Millennium Park. Buckingham Fountain? Right by the marsh? I imagine my mother and father sitting beside a fountain, under the spray of water, their feet skimming the concrete bottom. I know the fountain Zoe is referring to hasn't been operational for a long time, so the spraying water was never there. But the picture is prettier that way. The choosing ceremony was approaching, and your father was eager to leave erudite because he saw something terrible. What? What did he see? Well, your father was a good friend of Janine Matthews, says Zoe. He saw her performing an experiment on a factionless man in exchange for something, food or clothing, something like that. Anyway, she was testing the fear-inducing serum that was later incorporated into Dauntless Initiation. Long ago, the fear simulations weren't generated by a person's individual fears, you see. Just general fears, like heights or spiders or something. And Norton, then the representative of erudite, was there, letting it go on for far longer than it should have. The factionless man was never quite right again. And that was the last straw for your father. She pauses in front of the door to the labs to open it with her ID badge. We walk into the dingy office where David gave me my mother's journal. Matthew is sitting with his nose 3 inches from his computer screen, his eyes narrow. He barely registers our presence when we walk in. I feel overwhelmed by the desire to smile and cry at the same time. I sit down in the chair next to the empty desk, my hands clasped between my knees. My father was a difficult man, but he was also a good one. Your father wanted out of erudite, and your mother didn't want in, no matter what her mission was. But she still wanted to be near Andrew, so they chose abnegation together. She pauses. This caused a rift between your mother and David, as I'm sure you saw. He eventually apologized, but said he couldn't receive updates from her anymore. I don't know why. He wouldn't say. And after that, her reports were very short, very informational, which is why they're not in that journal. But she was still able to carry out her mission in abnegation. Yes, and she was much happier there, I think, than she would have been among the erudite. So he says, of course, abnegation turned out to be no better, in some ways. It seems there's no escaping the reach of genetic damage. Even the abnegation leadership was poisoned by it. I frown. Are you talking about Marcus? Because he's divergent. Genetic damage had nothing to do with it. A man surrounded by genetic damage cannot help but mimic it with his own behavior. Zoe says, Matthew, David wants to set up a meeting with your supervisor to discuss one of the serum developments. Last time, Alan completely forgot about it, so I was wondering if you could escort him? Sure, Matthew says without looking away from his computer. I'll get him to give me a time. Lovely. Well, I have to go. I hope that answered your question, Triss. She smiles at me and slips out the door. I sit hunched, with my elbows on my knees. Marcus was divergent, genetically pure, just like me. But I don't accept that he was a bad person because he was surrounded by genetically damaged people. So was I. So was Uriah. So was my mother. But none of us lashed out at our loved ones. Her argument has a few holes in it, doesn't it? Says Matthew. He's watching me from behind his desk, tapping his fingers on the arm of his chair. Yeah, I say. Some of the people here want to blame genetic damage for everything, he says. It's easier for them to accept than the truth, which is that they can't know everything about people and why they act the way they do. Everyone has to blame something for the way the world is, I say. For my father, it was the erudite. I probably shouldn't tell you that the erudite were always my favorite then, Matthew says, smiling a little. Really? I straighten. Why? I don't know. I guess I agree with them. That if everyone would just keep learning about the world around them, they would have far fewer problems. I've been wary of them my whole life, I say, resting my chin on my hand. My father hated the erudite, so I learned to hate them too, and everything they did with their time. Only now, I'm thinking he was wrong. Or just biased. About the erudite or about learning? I shrug. Both? So many of the erudite helped me when I didn't ask them to. Will, Fernando, Kara, all erudite, all some of the best people I've known, however briefly. They were so focused on making the world a better place. I shake my head. What Janine did has nothing to do with a thirst for knowledge, leading to a thirst for power, like my father told me, and everything to do with her being terrified of how big the world is and how powerless that made her. Maybe it was the Dauntless who had it right. There's an old phrase, Matthew says. Knowledge is power. Power to do evil, like Janine. Or power to do good, like what we're doing. Power itself is not evil. So knowledge itself is not evil. I guess I grew up suspicious of both. Power and knowledge, I say. To the abnegation, power should only be given to people who don't want it. There's something to that, Matthew says. But maybe it's time to grow out of that suspicion. He reaches under the desk and takes out a book. It is thick, with a worn cover and frayed edges. On it is printed, Human Biology. It's a little rudimentary, but this book helped to teach me what it is to be human, he says. To be such a complicated, mysterious piece of biological machinery, and more amazing still, to have the capacity to analyze that machinery. That is a special thing, unprecedented in all of evolutionary history. Our ability to know about ourselves and the world is what makes us human. He hands me the book and turns back to the computer. I look down at the worn cover and run my fingers along the edge of the pages. He makes the acquisition of knowledge feel like a secret, beautiful thing, and an ancient thing. I feel like if I read this book, I can reach backward through all the generations of humanity to the very first one, whenever it was, that I can participate in something many times larger and older than myself. Thank you, I say, and it's not for the book. It's for giving something back to me, something I lost before I was able to really have it. The lobby of the hotel smells like candied lemon and bleach, an acrid combination that burns my nostrils when I breathe it in. I walk past a potted plant with a garish flower blossoming among its branches, and toward the dormitory that has become our temporary home here. As I walk, I wipe the screen with the hem of my shirt, trying to get rid of some of my fingerprints. Caleb is alone in the dormitory, his hair tousled and his eyes red from sleep. He blinks at me when I walk in and toss the biology book onto my bed. I feel a sickening ache in my stomach and press the screen with our mother's file against my side. He's her son. He has a right to read her journal, just like you. If you have something to say, he says, just say it. Mom lived here. I blurt it out like a long-held secret, too loud and too fast. She came from the fringe, and they brought her here, and she lived here for a couple of years, then went into the city to stop the erudite from killing the divergent. Caleb blinks at me. Before I lose my nerve, I hold out the screen for him to take. Her file is here. It's not very long, but you should read it. He gets up and closes his hand around the glass. He's so much taller than he used to be, so much taller than I am. For a few years when we were children, I was the taller one, even though I was almost a year younger. Those were some of our best years, the ones where I didn't feel like he was bigger or better or smarter or more selfless than I was. How long have you known this? He says, narrowing his eyes. It doesn't matter. I step back. I'm telling you now. You can keep that, by the way. I'm done with it. He wipes the screen with his sleeve and navigates with deft fingers to our mother's first journal entry. I expect him to sit down and read it, thus ending the conversation, but instead he sighs. I have something to show you too, he says, about Edith Pryor. Come on. It's her name, not my lingering attachment to him that draws me after him when he starts to walk away. He leads me out of the dormitory and down the hallway and around corners to a room far away from any that I have seen in the bureau compound. It is long and narrow, the walls covered with shelves that bear identical blue-gray books, thick and heavy as dictionaries. Between the first two rows is a long wooden table with chairs tucked beneath it. Caleb flips the light switch, and pale light fills the room, reminding me of erudite headquarters. I've been spending a lot of time here, he says. It's the record room. They keep some of the Chicago experiment data in here. He walks along the shelves on the right side of the room, running his fingers over the book spines. He pulls out one of the volumes and lays it flat on the table, so it spills open, its pages covered in text and pictures. Why don't they keep all this on computers? I assume they kept these records before they developed a sophisticated security system on their network, he says without looking up. Data never fully disappears, but paper can be destroyed forever, so you can actually get rid of it if you don't want the wrong people to get their hands on it. It's safer sometimes to have everything printed out. His green eyes shift back and forth as he searches for the right place, his fingers nimble, built for turning pages. I think of how he disguised that part of himself, wedging books between his headboard and the wall in our abnegation house, until he dropped his blood in the erudite water on the day of our choosing ceremony. I should have known then that he was a liar, with loyalty only to himself. I feel that sickening ache again. I can hardly stand to be in here with him. The door closing us in. Nothing but the table between us. Ah, here. He touches his finger to a page, then spins the book around to show me. It looks like a copy of a contract, but it's handwritten in ink. I, Amanda Marie Ritter, of Peoria, Illinois, give my consent to the following procedures. The genetic healing procedure, as defined by the Bureau of Genetic Welfare. A genetic engineering procedure designed to correct the genes specified as damaged on page 3 of this form. The reset procedure, as defined by the Bureau of Genetic Welfare. A memory erasing procedure designed to make an experiment participant more fit for the experiment. I declare that I have been thoroughly instructed as to the risks and benefits of these procedures by a member of the Bureau of Genetic Welfare. I understand that this means I will be given a new background and a new identity by the Bureau and inserted into the experiment in Chicago, Illinois, where I will live out the remainder of my days. I agree to reproduce at least twice to give my corrected genes the best possible chance of survival. I understand that I will be encouraged to do this when I am re-educated after the reset procedure. I also give my consent for my children and my children's children, etc., to continue in this experiment until such time as the Bureau of Genetic Welfare deems it to be complete. They will be instructed in the false history that I myself will be given after the reset procedure. Signed, Amanda Marie Ritter. Amanda Marie Ritter. She was the woman in the video. Edith Pryor, my ancestor. I look up at Caleb, whose eyes are alight with knowledge, like there's a live wire running through each of them. Our ancestor. I pull out one of the chairs and sit. She was Dad's ancestor? He nods and sits down across from me. 7 generations back. Yes, an aunt. Her brother is the one who carried on the prior name. And this is... It's a consent form, he says. Her consent form for joining the experiment. The end notes say that this was just a first draft. She was one of the original experiment designers, a member of the Bureau. There were only a few Bureau members in the original experiment. Most of the people in the experiment weren't working for the government. I read the words again, trying to make sense of them. When I saw her in the video, it seemed so logical that she would become a resident of our city, that she would immerse herself in our factions, that she would volunteer to leave behind everything she left behind. But that was before I knew what life was like outside the city, and it doesn't seem as horrific as what Edith described in her message to us. She delivered a skillful manipulation in that video, which was intended to keep us contained and dedicated to the vision of the Bureau. The world outside the city is badly broken, and the Divergent need to come out here and heal it. It's not quite a lie, because the people in the Bureau do believe that healed genes will fix certain things, that if we integrate into the general population and pass our genes on, the world will be a better place. But they didn't need the Divergent to march out of our city like an army to fight injustice and save everyone, as Edith suggested. I wonder if Edith Pryor believed her own words, or if she just said them because she had to. There's a photograph of her on the next page, her mouth in a firm line, wisps of brown hair hanging around her face. She must have seen something terrible, to volunteer for her memory to be erased and her entire life remade. Do you know why she joined? I say. Caleb shakes his head. The records suggest, though they're fairly vague on this front, that people joined the experiment so their families could escape extreme poverty. The families of the subjects were offered a monthly stipend for the subjects' participation. for upward of 10 years. But obviously that wasn't Edith's motivation, since she worked for the Bureau. I suspect something traumatic must have happened to her, something she was determined to forget. I frown at her photograph. I can't imagine what kind of poverty would motivate a person to forget themselves and everyone they loved so their families could get a monthly stipend. I may have lived on abnegation bread and vegetables for most of my life, with nothing to spare, but I was never that desperate. Their situation must have been much worse than anything I saw in the city. I can't imagine why Edith was that desperate either. Or maybe it's just that she didn't have anyone to keep her memory for. I was interested in the legal precedent for giving consent on behalf of one's descendants, Caleb says. I think it's an extrapolation of giving consent for one's children under 18, but it seems a little odd. I guess we all decide our children's fates just by making our own life decisions, I say vaguely. Would we have chosen the same factions we did if Mom and Dad hadn't chosen abnegation? I shrug. I don't know. Maybe we wouldn't have felt as stifled. Maybe we would have become different people. The thought creeps into my mind like a slithering creature. Maybe we would have become better people. People who don't betray their own sisters. I stare at the table in front of me. For the past few minutes, it was easy to pretend that Caleb and I were just brother and sister again. But a person can only keep reality and anger at bay for so long before the truth comes back again. As I raise my eyes to his, I think of looking at him in just this way, when I was still a prisoner in Erudite headquarters. I think of being too tired to fight with him anymore, or to hear his excuses, too tired to care that my brother had abandoned me. I ask tersely, Edith joined Erudite, didn't she? Even though she took an abnegation name. Yes. He doesn't seem to notice my tone. In fact, most of our ancestors were an Erudite. There were a few abnegation outliers, and one or two Candor. But the through line is fairly consistent. I feel cold, like I might shiver and then shatter. So I suppose you've used this as an excuse in your twisted mind for what you did, I say steadily. For joining Erudite, for being loyal to them. I mean, if you were supposed to be one of them all along, then faction before blood is an acceptable thing to believe, right? Triss, he says, and his eyes plead with me for understanding. But I do not understand. I won't. I stand up. So, now I know about Edith and you know about our mother. Good. Let's just leave it at that then. Sometimes, when I look at him, I feel the ache of sympathy toward him. And sometimes, I feel like I want to wrap my hands around his throat. But right now, I just want to escape and pretend this never happened. I walk out of the records room, and my shoes squeak on the tile floor as I run back to the hotel. I run until I smell sweet citrus, and then I stop. Tobias is standing in the hallway outside the dormitory. I am breathless, and I can feel my heartbeat even in my fingertips. I am overwhelmed, teeming with loss and wonder and anger and longing. Triss, Tobias says, his brow furrowed with concern. Are you all right? I shake my head, still struggling for air, and crush him against the wall with my body, my lips finding his. For a moment he tries to push me away, but then he must decide that he doesn't care if I'm all right. Doesn't care if he's all right. Doesn't care. We haven't been alone together in days, weeks, months. His fingers slide into my hair, and I hold on to his arms to stay steady as we press together like two blades at a stalemate. He is stronger than anyone I know, and warmer than anyone else realizes. He is a secret that I have kept, and will keep, for the rest of my life. He leans down and kisses my throat, hard, and his hands smooth over me, securing themselves at my waist. I hook my fingers in his belt loops, my eyes closing. In that moment, I know exactly what I want. I want to peel away all the layers of clothing between us, strip away everything that separates us, the past and the present and the future. I hear footsteps and laughter at the end of the hallway, and we break apart. Someone, probably Uriah, whistles, but I barely hear it over the pulsing in my ears. Tobias's eyes meet mine, and it's like the first time I really looked at him during my initiation, after my fear simulation. We stare too long, too intently. "Shut up," I call out to Uriah, without looking away. Uriah and Christina walk into the dormitory, and Tobias and I follow them, like nothing happened.
Chapter 23. Tobias. That night, when my head hits the pillow, heavy with thoughts, I hear something crinkle beneath my cheek, a note under my pillowcase. "T, meet me outside the hotel entrance at 11. I need to talk to you. Nita." I look at Triss's cot. She's sprawled on her back, and there is a piece of hair covering her nose and mouth that shifts with each exhale. I don't want to wake her, but I feel strange going to meet a girl in the middle of the night without telling her about it, especially now that we're trying so hard to be honest with each other. I check my watch. It's 10 to 11. "Nita's just a friend. You can tell Triss tomorrow. It might be urgent." I push the blankets back and shove my feet into my shoes. I sleep in my clothes these days. I pass Peter's cot, then Uriah's. The top of a flask peeks out from beneath Uriah's pillow. I pinch it between my fingers and carry it toward the door, where I slide it under the pillow on one of the empty cots. I haven't been looking after him as well as I promised Zeke I would. Once I'm in the hallway, I tie my shoes and smooth my hair down. I stopped cutting it like the abnegation when I wanted the Dauntless to see me as a potential leader, but I missed the ritual of the old way. The buzz of the clippers and the careful movements of my hands, knowing more by touch than by sight. When I was young, my father used to do it, in the hallway on the top floor of our abnegation house. He was always too careless with the blade, and scraped the back of my neck or nicked my ear. But he never complained about having to cut my hair for me. That's something, I guess. Nita is tapping her foot. This time she wears a white short-sleeved shirt, her hair pulled back. She smiles, but it doesn't quite reach her eyes. "You look worried," I say. "That's because I am," she answers. "Come on, there's a place I've been wanting to show you." She leads me down dim hallways, empty except for the occasional janitor. They all seem to know Nita. They wave at her or smile. She puts her hands in her pockets, guiding her eyes carefully away from mine every time we happen to look at each other. We go through a door without a security sensor to keep it locked. The room beyond it is a wide circle with a chandelier marking its center with dangling glass. The floors are polished wood, dark, and the walls, covered in sheets of bronze, gleam where the light touches them. There are names inscribed on bronze panels, dozens of names. Nita stands beneath the glass chandelier and holds her arms out wide to encompass the room in her gesture. "These are the Chicago family trees," she says. "Your family trees." I move closer to one of the walls and read through the names, searching for one that looks familiar. At the end, I find one. Uriah Pedred and Ezekiel Pedred. Next to each name is a small DD, and there's a dot next to Uriah's name, and it looks freshly carved, marking him as divergent, probably. "Do you know where mine is?" I say. She crosses the room and touches one of the panels. "The generations are matrilineal. That's why Janine's record said Triss was second generation, because her mother came from outside the city. I'm not sure how Janine knew that, but I guess we'll never find out." I approach the panel that bears my name with trepidation, though I'm not sure what I have to fear from seeing my name and my parents' names carved into bronze. I see a vertical line connecting Kristen Johnson to Evelyn Johnson, and a horizontal one connecting Evelyn Johnson to Marcus Eaton. Below the two names is just one, Tobias Eaton. The small letters beside my name are AD, and there's a dot there too, though I know I'm not actually divergent. The first letter is your faction of origin, she says, and the second is your faction of choice. They thought that keeping track of the factions would help them trace the path of the genes. My mother's letters. E-A-F. The F is for factionless, I assume. My father's letters. A-A with a dot. I touch the line connecting me to them, and the line connecting Evelyn to her parents, and the line connecting them to their parents all the way back through 8 generations, counting my own. This is a map of what I've always known, that I am tied to them, bound forever to this empty inheritance no matter how far I run. While I appreciate you showing me this, I say, and I feel sad and tired. I'm not sure why it had to happen in the middle of the night. I thought you might want to see it. And I had something I wanted to talk to you about. More reassurance that my limitations don't define me? I shake my head. No, thanks. I've had enough of that. No, she says. But I'm glad you said that. She leans against the panel, covering Evelyn's name with her shoulder. I step back, not wanting to be so close to her that I can see the ring of lighter brown around her pupils. That conversation I had with you last night, about genetic damage, it was actually a test. I wanted to see how you would react to what I said about damaged genes so I would know whether I could trust you or not, she says. If you accepted what I said about your limitations, the answer would have been no. She slides a little closer to me so her shoulder covers Marcus's name too. See, I'm not really on board with being classified as damaged. I think of the way she spat out the explanation of the tattoo of broken glass on her back like it was poison. My heart starts to beat harder so I can feel the pulse in my throat. Bitterness has replaced the good humor in her voice, and her eyes have lost their warmth. I am afraid of her. Afraid of what she says, and thrilled by it too, because it means I don't have to accept that I am smaller than I once believed. I take it you aren't on board with it either, she says. No, I'm not. There are a lot of secrets in this place, she says. One of them is that to them, a GD is expendable. Another is that some of us are not just going to sit back and take it. What do you mean expendable? I say. The crimes they have committed against people like us are serious, Nita says, and hidden. I can show you evidence, but that will have to come later. For now, what I can tell you is that we're working against the Bureau, for good reasons, and we want you with us. I narrow my eyes. Why? What is it you want from me, exactly? Right now, I want to offer you an opportunity to see what the world is like outside the compound. And what you get in return is... Your protection, she says. I'm going to a dangerous place, and I can't tell anyone else from the Bureau about it. You're an outsider, which means it's safe for me to trust you, and I know you know how to defend yourself. And if you come with me, I'll show you that evidence you want to see. She touches her heart, lightly, as if swearing on it. My skepticism is strong, but my curiosity is stronger. It's not hard for me to believe that the Bureau would do bad things, because every government I've ever known has done bad things, even the abnegation oligarchy, of which my father was the head. And even beyond that reasonable suspicion, I have brewing inside me the desperate hope that I am not damaged, that I am worth more than the corrected genes I pass on to any children I might have. So I decide to go along with this. For now. Fine, I say. First, she says, before I show you anything, you have to accept that you won't be able to tell anyone, even Triss, about what you see. Are you all right with that? She's trustworthy, you know. I promised Triss I wouldn't keep any secrets from her anymore. I shouldn't get into situations where I'll have to do it again. Why can't I tell her? I'm not saying she isn't trustworthy. It's just that she doesn't have the skill set we need, and we don't want to put anyone at risk that we don't have to. See, the Bureau doesn't want us to organize. If we believe we're not damaged, then we're saying that everything they're doing, the experiments, the genetic alterations, all of it, is a waste of time. And no one wants to hear that their life's work is a sham. I know all about that. It's like finding out that the factions are an artificial system designed by scientists to keep us under control for as long as possible. She pulls away from the wall, and then she says the only thing she could possibly say to make me agree. If you tell her, you would be depriving her of the choice I'm giving you now. You would force her to become a co-conspirator. By keeping this from her, you would be protecting her. I run my fingers over my name, carved into the metal panel. Tobias Eaton. These are my genes. This is my mess. I don't want to pull Triss into it. All right, I say. Show me. I watch her flashlight beam bob up and down with her footsteps. We just retrieved a bag from a mop closet down the hall. She was ready for this. She leads me deep into the underground hallways of the compound, past the place where the GDs gather, to a corridor where the electricity no longer flows. At a certain place, she crouches and slides her hand along the ground until her fingers reach a latch. She hands me the flashlight and pulls back the latch, lifting a door from the tile. It's an escape tunnel, she says. They dug it when they first came here, so there would always be a way to escape during an emergency. From her bag, she takes a black tube and twists off the top. It sprays sparks of light that glow red against her skin. She releases it over the doorway and it falls several feet, leaving a streak of light on my eyelids. She sits on the edge of the hole, her backpack secure around her shoulders, and drops. I know it's just a short way down, but it feels like more with the space open beneath me. I sit, the silhouette of my shoes dark against the red sparks, and push myself forward. Interesting, Nita says when I land. I lift up the flashlight and she holds the flare out in front of her as we walk down the tunnel, which is just wide enough for the two of us to walk side by side, and just tall enough for me to straighten up. It smells rich and rotten, like mold and dead air. I forgot you were afraid of heights. Well, I'm not afraid of much else, I say. No need to get defensive, she smiles. I actually have always wanted to ask you about that. I step over a puddle, the soles of my shoes gripping the gritty tunnel floor. Your third fear, she says, shooting that woman. Who was she? The flare goes out, so the flashlight I'm holding is our only guide through the tunnel. I shift my arm to create more space between us, not wanting to skim her arm in the dark. She wasn't anyone in particular, I say. The fear was shooting her. You were afraid of shooting people? No, I say. I was afraid of my considerable capacity to kill. She is silent, and so am I. That's the first time I've ever said those words out loud, and now I hear how strange they are. How many young men fear that there is a monster inside them? People are supposed to fear others, not themselves. People are supposed to aspire to become their fathers, not shudder at the thought. I've always wondered what would be in my fear landscape. She says it in hushed tone, like a prayer. Sometimes I feel like there is so much to be afraid of, and sometimes I feel like there is nothing left to fear. I nod, though she can't see me, and we keep moving, the flashlight beam bouncing, our shoes scraping, the moldy air rushing toward us from whatever is on the other end. After 20 minutes of walking, we turn a corner, and I smell fresh wind, cold enough to make me shudder. I turn off the flashlight and the moonlight at the end of the tunnel guides us to our exit. The tunnel led us out somewhere in the wasteland we drove through to get to the compound, among the crumbling buildings and overgrown trees breaking through the pavement. Parked a few feet away is an old truck, the back covered in shredded threadbare canvas. Nita kicks one of the tires to test it, then climbs into the driver's seat. The keys already dangle from the ignition. Whose truck? I say when I get into the passenger seat. It belongs to the people we're going to meet. I asked them to park it here, she says. And who are they? Friends of mine. I don't know how she finds her way through the maze of streets before us, but she does, steering the truck around tree roots and fallen streetlights, flashing the headlights at animals that scamper at the edge of my vision. A long-legged creature with a brown, spare body picks its way across the street ahead of us, almost as tall as the headlights. Nita eases on the brake so she doesn't hit it. Its ears twitch, and its dark, round eyes watch us with careful curiosity like a child. sort of beautiful, aren't they? She says. Before I came here, I'd never seen a deer. I nod. It is elegant, but hesitant, halting. Nita presses the horn with her fingertips and the deer moves out of the way. We accelerate again, then reach a wide, open road suspended across the railroad tracks I once walked down to reach the compound. I see its lights up ahead, the one bright spot in this dark wasteland. And we are traveling northeast, away from it. It is a long time before I see electric light again. When I do, it is along a narrow, patchy street. The bulbs dangle from a cord strung across the old streetlights. We stop here. Nita jerks the wheel, pulling the truck into an alley between two brick buildings. She takes the keys from the ignition and looks at me. Check in the glove box. I ask them to give us weapons. I open the compartment in front of me. Sitting on top of some old wrappers are two knives. How are you with a knife? She says. The Dauntless taught initiates how to throw knives even before the changes to initiation that Max made before I joined them. I never liked it, because it seemed like a way to encourage the Dauntless flair for theatrics rather than a useful skill. I'm all right, I say with a smirk. I never thought that skill would actually be worth anything, though. I guess the Dauntless are good for something after all. For, she says, smiling a little. She takes the larger of the two knives and I take the smaller one. I am tense, turning the handle in my fingers as we walk down the alley. Above me, the windows flicker with a different kind of light. Flames from candles or lanterns. At one point when I glance up, I see a curtain of hair and dark eye sockets staring back at me. People live here, I say. This is the very edge of the fringe, Nita says. It's about a 2-hour drive from Milwaukee, which is a metropolitan area north of here. Yeah, people live here. These days people don't venture too far away from cities, even if they want to live outside the government's influence, like the people here. Why do they want to live outside the government's influence? I know what living outside the government is like by watching the factionless. They were always hungry, always cold in the winter and hot in the summer, always struggling to survive. It's not an easy life to choose. You have to have a good reason for it. Because they're genetically damaged, Nita says, glancing at me. Genetically damaged people are technically, legally equal to genetically pure people, but only on paper, so to speak. In reality, they're poorer, more likely to be convicted of crimes, less likely to be hired for good jobs, you name it. It's a problem, and has been since the Purity War over a century ago. For the people who live in the fringe, it seemed more appealing to opt out of society completely rather than to try to correct the problem from within, like I intend to do. I think of the fragment of glass tattooed on her skin. I wonder when she got it. I wonder what put that dangerous look in her eyes, what put such drama in her speech, what made her become a revolutionary. How do you plan on doing that? She sets her jaw and says, by taking away some of the Bureau's power. The alley opens up to a wide street. Some people prowl along the edges, but others walk right in the middle, in lurching groups, bottles swinging from their hands. Everyone I see is young. Not many adults in the fringe, I guess. I hear shouting up ahead, and glass shattering on the pavement. A crowd there stands in a circle around two punching, kicking figures. I start toward them, but Nita grabs my arm and drags me toward one of the buildings. Not the time to be a hero, she says. We approach the door to the building on the corner. A large man stands beside it, spinning a knife in his palm. When we walk up the steps, he stops the knife and tosses it into his other hand, which is gnarled with scars. His size, his deftness with the weapon, his scarred and dusty appearance, they are all supposed to intimidate me. But his eyes are like that deer's eyes, large and wary and curious. We're here to see Raffi, she says. We're from the compound.
You can go in, but your knives stay here, the man says.
His voice is higher, lighter than I expected. He could be a gentleman, maybe, if this were a different kind of place. As it is, I see that he isn't gentle. Doesn't even know what that means. Even though I myself have discarded any kind of softness as useless, I find myself thinking that something important is lost if this man has been forced to deny his own nature. Not a chance, Nita says.
Nita? Is that you?
Says a voice from inside. It is expressive, musical. The man to whom it belongs is short with a wide smile. He comes to the doorway.
Didn't I tell you to just let them in? Come in, come in.
Hi, Raffi, she says, her relief obvious. Four, this is Raffi. He's an important man in the fringe.
Nice to meet you,
Raffi says, as he beckons for us to follow him. Inside is a large, open room lit by rows of candles and lanterns. There is wooden furniture strewn everywhere, all the tables empty but one. A woman sits in the back of the room, and Raffi slides into the chair beside her. Though they don't look the same, she has red hair and a generous frame. His features are dark and his body spare as a wire. They have the same sort of look, like two stones hewn by the same chisel.
Weapons on the table, Raffi says.
This time Nita obeys, putting her knife on the edge of the table right in front of her. She sits. I do the same. Across from us, the woman surrenders a gun.
Who's this?
The woman says, jerking her head toward me.
This is my associate, Nita says. Four.
What kind of a name is Four?
She doesn't ask with a sneer, the way people have often asked me that question.
The kind you get inside the city experiment, Nita says, for having only four fears.
It occurs to me that she might have introduced me by that name just to have the opportunity to share where I'm from. Does it give her some kind of leverage? Does it make me more trustworthy to these people?
Interesting.
The woman taps the table with her index finger.
Well, Four, my name is Mary.
Mary and Raffi lead the Midwest branch of a GD rebel group, Nita says.
Calling it a group makes us sound like old ladies playing cards, Raffi says smoothly. We're more of an uprising. Our reach stretches across the country. There's a group for every metropolitan area that exists, and regional overseers for the Midwest, South, and East.
Is there a West? I say.
Not anymore, Nita says quietly. The terrain was too difficult to navigate, and the city's too spread out for it to be sensible to live there after the war. Now it's wild country.
So it's true what they say,
Mary says, her eyes catching the light like slivers of glass as she looks at me.
The people in the city experiments really don't know what's outside. Of course it's true. Why would they? Nita says.
Fatigue, a weight behind my eyes, creeps up on me suddenly. I've been a part of too many uprisings in my short life. The factionless, and now this GD one, apparently.
Not to cut the pleasantries short, Mary says, but we shouldn't spend much time here. We can't keep people out for long before they come sniffing around.
Right, Nita says. She looks at me.
Four, can you make sure nothing's happening outside? I need to talk to Mary and Raffi privately for a little while.
If we were alone, I would ask why I can't be here when she talks to them, or why she bothered to bring me in when I could have stood guard outside the whole time. I guess I haven't actually agreed to help her yet, and she must have wanted them to meet me for some reason. So I just get up, taking my knife with me, and walk to the door where Raffi's guard watches the street. The fight across the street has died down. A lone figure lies on the pavement. For a moment I think it's still moving, but then I realize that's because someone is rifling through its pockets. It's not a figure. It's a body.
Dead,
I say, and the word is just an exhale.
Yep. If you can't defend yourself here, you won't last the night.
Why do people come here then, I frown. Why don't they just go back to the cities? He's quiet for so long that I think he must not have heard my question. I watch the thief turn the dead person's pockets inside out and abandon the body, slipping into one of the nearby buildings. Finally, Raffi's guard speaks.
Here there's a chance that if you die, someone will care. Like Raffi or one of the other leaders, the guard says. In the cities, if you get killed, definitely no one will give a damn. Not if you're a GD. The worst crime I've ever seen a GP get charged with for killing a GD was manslaughter. Bullshit.
Manslaughter? It means the crime is deemed an accident, Raffi's smooth, lilting voice says behind me.
Or at least not as severe as, say, first-degree murder. Officially, of course, we're all treated the same, yes? But that is rarely put into practice.
He stands beside me, his arms folded. I see when I look at him a king surveying his own kingdom, which he believes is beautiful. I look out at the street, at the broken pavement and the limp body with its turned-out pockets, and the windows flickering with firelight, and I know the beauty he sees is just freedom. Freedom to be seen as a whole man instead of a damaged one. I saw that freedom once, when Evelyn beckoned to me from among the factionless, called me out of my faction to become a more complete person. But it was a lie.
You're from Chicago?
Raffi says to me. I nod, still looking at the dark street.
And now that you are out, how does the world seem to you?
He says. Mostly the same, I say. People are just divided by different things, fighting different wars. Nita's footsteps creak on the floorboards inside, and when I turn, she is standing right behind me, her hands buried in her pockets.
Thanks for arranging this, Nita says, nodding to Raffi. It's time for us to go.
We make our way down the street again, and when I turn to look at Raffi, he has his hand up, waving goodbye. As we walk back to the truck, I hear screams again, but this time they are the screams of a child. I walk past snuffling, whimpering sounds and think of when I was younger, crouching in my bedroom, wiping my nose on one of my sleeves. My mother used to scrub the cuffs with a sponge before throwing them in the wash. She never said anything about it. When I get into the truck, I already feel numb to this place and its pain, and I am ready to get back to the dream of the compound, the warmth and the light and the feeling of safety. I'm having trouble understanding why this place is preferable to city life, I say.
I've only been to a city that wasn't an experiment once, Nita says. There's electricity, but it's on a ration system. Each family only gets so many hours a day. Same with water. And there's a lot of crime, which is blamed on genetic damage. There are police, too, but they can only do so much.
So the Bureau compound, I say. It's easily the best place to live, then.
In terms of resources, yes, Nita says. But the same social system that exists in the cities also exists in the compound. It's just a little harder to see.
I watch the fringe disappear in the rearview mirror, distinct from the abandoned buildings around it only by the string of electric lights draped over the narrow street. We drive past dark houses with boarded-up windows, and I try to imagine them clean and polished as they must have been at some point in the past. They have fenced-in yards that must have once been trim and green, windows that must once have glowed in the evenings. I imagine that the lives lived here were peaceful ones, quiet ones.
What did you come out here to talk to them about, exactly?
I say.
I came out here to solidify our plans, Nita says.
I notice in the glow of the dashboard light that there are a few cuts on her lower lip, like she has spent too much time biting it.
And I wanted them to meet you, to put a face on the people inside the faction experiments. Mary used to be suspicious that people like you were actually colluding with the government, which of course isn't true. Raffi, though, he was the first person to give me proof that the Bureau, the government, was lying to us about our history.
She pauses after she says it, like that will help me to feel the weight of it. But I don't need time or silence or space to believe her. I have been lied to by my government for my entire life.
The Bureau talks about this golden age of humanity before the genetic manipulations in which everyone was genetically pure and everything was peaceful, Nita says. But Raffi showed me old photographs of war.
I wait a beat. So?
So, Nita demands, incredulous, if genetically pure people caused war and total devastation in the past at the same magnitude that genetically damaged people supposedly do now, then what's the basis for thinking that we need to spend so many resources and so much time working to correct genetic damage? What's the use of the experiments at all, except to convince the right people that the government is doing something to make all our lives better, even though it's not?
The truth changes everything. Isn't that why Triss was so desperate to get the Edith Pryor video shown that she allied herself with my father to do it? She knew that the truth, whatever it was, would change our struggle, would shift our priorities forever. And here, now, a lie has changed the struggle. A lie has shifted priorities forever. Instead of working against the poverty or crime that have run rampant over this country, these people have chosen to work against genetic damage. Why? Why spend so much time and energy fighting something that isn't really a problem? I demand, suddenly frustrated.
Well, the people fighting it now probably fight it because they have been taught that it is a problem. That's another thing that Raffi showed me, examples of the propaganda the government released about genetic damage, Nita says. But initially, I don't know. It's probably a dozen things. Prejudice against GDs? Control, maybe? Control the genetically damaged population by teaching them that there's something wrong with them, and control the genetically pure population by teaching them that they're healed and whole. These things don't happen overnight, and they don't happen for just one reason.
I lean the side of my head against the cold window and close my eyes. There is too much information buzzing in my brain to focus on any single part of it, so I give up trying and let myself drift off. By the time we make it back through the tunnel and I find my bed, the sun is about to rise, and Triss's arm is hanging over the edge of her bed again, her fingertips brushing the floor. I sit down across from her, for a moment watching her sleeping face and thinking of what we agreed that night in Millennium Park. No more lies. She promised me, and I promised her. And if I don't tell her about what I heard and saw tonight, I will be going back on that promise. And for what? To protect her? For Nita, a girl I barely know? I brush her hair away from her face, gently so I don't wake her. She doesn't need my protection. She's strong enough on her own.
Chapter 24. Triss. Peter is across the room, gathering a stack of books into a pile and shoving them into a bag. He bites down on a red pen and carries the bag out of the room. I hear the books inside it smacking against his leg as he walks down the hallway. I wait until I can't hear them anymore before I turn to Christina. I've been trying not to ask you, but I'm giving up, I say. What's going on with you and Uriah? Christina, sprawled across her cot with one long leg dangling over the edge, gives me a look. What? You've been spending a lot of time together, I say. Like, a lot. It's sunny today, the light glowing through the white curtains. I don't know how, but the dormitory smells like sleep, like laundry and shoes and night sweats and morning coffee. Some of the beds are made, and some still have rumpled sheets bunched up at the bottom or the side. Most of us came from Dauntless, but I'm struck by how different we are anyway. Different habits, different temperaments, different ways of seeing the world. You may not believe me, but it's not like that. Christina props herself up on her elbows. He's grieving. We're both bored. Also, he's Uriah. So? He's good-looking. Good-looking, but he can't have a serious conversation to save his life. Christina shakes her head. Don't get me wrong. I like to laugh. But I also want a relationship to mean something, you know? I nod. I do know. Better than most people. Maybe because Tobias and I aren't really the joking type. Besides, she says, not every friendship turns into a romance. I haven't tried to kiss you yet. I laugh. True. Where have you been lately? Christina says. She wiggles her eyebrows. With four? Doing a little addition, multiplication. I cover my face with my hands. That was the worst joke I've ever heard. Don't dodge the question. No audition for us, I say. Not yet, anyway. He's been a little preoccupied with the whole